had Paulus pulled down from the north of the pocket, got his few tanks left, I think they could have tried to make a breakout. And the Luftwaffe could have airdropped supplies as they broke out and headed towards Manstein. But the Luftwaffe was never given that opportunity to do that, yeah, because Hitler said the Sixth Army must remain on the Volga and you will not give up any ground. Yeah. And so there they stayed and there they died.
Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. And welcome to Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and thank you for joining us today. Today I'm joined by Robert Forsyth. Robert, of course, is an author, he's an editor and publisher specializing in historic military aviation. Robert set up his own publishing company in 1994 and published his first book then, but went on to write more than 30 other titles on aircraft, campaigns and units of the Luftwaffe, an interest he's held since boyhood. Robert is a member of the editorial board of the Aviation Historian and was, of course, an expert guest on our Coastal Command series. He also featured in episode 126 on the Luftwaffe's special weapons. Robert, welcome back to Extended.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Well, we're going to talk about the Stalingrad airlift, a topic that certainly I was very unaware of. But we talked a while ago, heard that you were writing the story, the book, and now we're here. So we'll come back to the book in a short while, but why the Stalingrad airlift?
Right. Well, the truth is I never sort of consciously set out to write about it. It was circumstance, really. First of all, as we both view this, and probably most people view it, it was an epic land battle, and it's been associated as a land battle, and the historiography generally focuses on the land side. But I was researching the life of a German commander, Field Marshal Wolfram von Richthofen, which is another project I'm working on. And, you know, it's a long term project, and he was a commander, and we'll come on to this probably later, but he was a commander at Stalingrad, an air commander at Stalingrad. And because I was working on studying his life and campaigns, he was involved at Stalingrad, and he kept diaries. And his diaries, I just read these diaries, and through the goodness of other fellow researchers and friends, I came across the diaries of other German air commanders who commanded what became the airlift attempt at Stalingrad. And they kept diaries, and these were even have been translated into English. And in reading them, I just was struck by, you know, there was such a story there, you know, the adversity. And as you know, again, we'll come on to that, but there was just this epic story, which often gets sidelined, or it gets reduced to a footnote in many studies and accounts. And understandably, because no one's ever really, really gone into it in real depth, aside from a small number of writers and former commanders. So, yeah, I mean, armed with these diaries, I just thought, let's look at this. And I was very conscious, Peter, that it was a passive. It's viewed as a passive operation, by which I mean that there weren't guns blazing. You know, there weren't dogfights. Well, there were dogfights, but there was, it yeah. wasn't something like the Battle of Britain or, you know, like the defense of the Reich or, you know, B-17s getting shot down. It was something that was distant to us here in the West. And an airlift is seen as a passive operation. So that's really how I came to it. And then I was also struck by the fact that there were three dynamics in this story. One was the, you know, from the reason for writing a book, one was the dynamic of the ticking clock, because the Germans were becoming, the Sixth Army was becoming increasingly surrounded in this city called Stalingrad. So there was a ticking clock that they had to get out, or they had to get them out. The second dynamic was the appalling weather, the conditions that these men in the pocket and outside the pocket, the airmen that were trying to get them out, faced. And the third dynamic was this clash of megalomaniac personalities, you know, from Hitler to Goering, right the way down to the, you know, some of the field commanders, this sort of clash of personalities, and which also had a massive impact on the whole operation. So those three dynamics, it was the diaries, really, the discovery of the diaries. I won't say they fell in my lap, but the discoveries of the diaries and those three dynamics of the ticking clock, the weather, and the personalities, it struck me as this is a heck of a story. And that's why I did it. But I didn't set out to do it. It was something that just organically happened.
Well, let's take a step back then before we jump into that detail and put a little bit of context around Stalingrad, because, again, like many others, it's whilst it's well known, I'm not sure a lot of people understand what, like myself, my good self, were a little bit naive to what actually happened at Stalingrad, and therefore why the airlift was needed. So can you just give us that sort of wider context of what happened and what led to this situation?
Sure. Well, it basically was down to oil at the end of the day. The Germans had obviously launched Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet Union in the summer of 1941. They basically, like Napoleon, got stopped outside Moscow. Whichever way you dress it up, that's what happened. Again, bad weather. General Winter kicked in and, you know, everything came to a stop. And then in June 1942, Hitler launched a summer offensive and it was the big summer offensive, the German summer offensive into Russia. And it was known as Operation Blue. And the ultimate target really was to get to the Caucasus. So the German line was running really from Moscow south. And if you imagine the geography of the Soviet Union in very broad terms, the oil fields of the Caucasus lie a long way to the southeast. So Hitler really needed oil badly, big time, to fuel his continuing military war aims and aspirations. He needed the oil. So Operation Blau was the thrust from the German line southeast into the Caucasus and along the north of the Black Sea and the Crimea, cutting into the Caucasus. And to be honest, that Stalingrad wasn't really part of, you know, really wasn't really part of the initial strategic thinking on this. The plan was to launch two divergent thrusts. There was Army Group A was to move towards the Don and along the Dönitz River down towards the Caucasus, while Army Group B was to move towards the Volga River. Now, and basically was to protect the northern flank of Army Group B was to protect the northern flank of Army Group B as it thrust southeast towards the Caucasus. And Army Group B was to take the to head for the Volga. Now obviously on the Volga sits Stalingrad, but Stalingrad, there was just this vague, perhaps what not many people realized, there was just this vague notion that they used in Hitler's directive the word reach, not attack, not take, not surround, but reach Stalingrad. And as one general has written in his memoirs, who was attached to the German high command, you know, how do you define reach? Really define it. It's a very vague word. So Basically, Army Group B chunted off along into southern Russia, ostensibly protecting the northern flank of its sister army group, and it just aims for Stalingrad, and that's it. There's nothing more beyond that. So, to be honest with you, it was just this, if you could imagine this massive army, the Sixth Army, commanded by General, as he was then, Paulus, just went along the heat and the dust, the high summer, you know, the ground is firm, it's good for tanks, they've got air support, Ju 87 Stukas shooting up T-34s. They've got Heinkel 111, Junkers 88 medium bombers, you know, taking out transport targets, You know, Soviet logistics points. It's all going swimmingly. It's blitzkrieg, you know, it's going well. As I said, a lot of heat, a lot of dust. And then slowly, you know, the Russians do start, they dig in with their T-34s. Get to September becomes October, the weather starts getting a little bit colder, and they haven't quite made the ground they thought they were going to make. But nevertheless, Hitler says, go, 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 keep going. And it's like this army getting sucked into this big sort of vortex, if you like. And at the end of this vortex is this city called Stalingrad. And of course, you know, Stalin is in the... you know, it was a latter name for it. So there is this emotional, this clash of titans, you know, there's the man sitting in Moscow and then there's the man sitting in Berlin or Rastenburg or, you know, his field, the Wolf's Lair, his field headquarters. And these two dictators know, they can see what's happening. And Hitler believed in the superiority of his armies. And as far as he was concerned, woof, he just cut through it like a hot knife through butter and get to Stalingrad.
It didn't quite pan out that way, though, did it? Those forces ground to a halt, the stalemate ensued. And that's what started to create what we, what you write about, but what is more well known as the pocket.
Well, the problem is that eventually in November, mid-November, the Soviet launched something called Operation Uranus, and basically the pincers event inevitably, the Germans didn't see it coming. They had no idea that the Soviets were amassing huge forces on the eastern bank of the Volga, and they struck, and for the first time ever an entire German field army was basically trapped in a pincer and cut off. So that being the case, Hitler said, you will not give ground, you will not surrender, you will fight on. Because his view was that he would, by staying firm in Stalingrad, he would tie down other forces, the Soviet forces, which could be used elsewhere. Yeah. And in order to keep those men there, was airlift. You had to have aircraft. So That's how the airlift started. The problem is that the Germans, for the dichotomy, the paradox, if you like, is that the Germans, for being such a, you know, the people who placed a lot of emphasis on high-speed mobile warfare, blitzkrieg, you know, you'd think that they would support their ground forces with transport. But the thing with the Germans is, surprisingly, this is one of the things that struck me as being strange, is they didn't actually place a lot of emphasis or priority on air transport. It was always something as a bit of an afterthought, despite this German high mobility doctrine. And also, you know, they developed in the 1930s a very sophisticated airline, Deutsche Lufthansa, and they had, you know, they had some amazing, you know, the Ju-52,
yeah,
the
great capabilities, yeah,
absolutely. But transport was always, military transport was always slightly forgotten and was never given a high priority. So transport doubled up as training aircraft. There was no autonomous, really, no autonomous training command. And then the war starts, and in the quote unquote easier campaigns, Scandinavia, France, the Blitzkrieg, you know, going into the Balkans, you know, such was the speed of the advances that they did achieve their war aims. But within when North Africa happened, suddenly they've got the Mediterranean in the way, and they became stretched. And, you know, these Ju-52s were having to fly supplies over the Mediterranean into North Africa. Bang! The second front is there in the form of Russia and Stalingrad. And suddenly they realize that they just don't have enough transport aircrafts to do the job.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in the meantime, these poor guys in the Sixth Army, you know, hundreds of thousands of men have got close, you know, captured, you know, stuck in these awful ruins, you know, these vast ruins, which their Stukas, their Ju-87s had bombed and turned into rubble and wasteland, and their Heinkel-111s and Ju-88s, Richthofen's aircraft. And Richthofen was, incidentally, a cousin of Manfred von Richthofen, the Red Baron. He was a cousin. And he really, he was a strong proponent of, you know, go in, hit hard, you know, knock them dead. So they were fighting in the ruins that, in a sense, the Luftwaffe had created. They called it Rattenkrieg, which is rat's warfare. And unfortunately, the Sixth Army was commanded by just about the worst commander they could count on, which was Paulus, who was when it came to dealing with Hitler, he just didn't have a strong enough personality. Yeah. So they stayed on the Volga, as the term was. We remain on the Volga. And the weather changed, and the snow came, and the Russians had surrounded them. And the other thing I should say is that there was a precedent already, because the Luftwaffe had supplied two other pockets in 1941 at Demyansk and Kurn. And there were different circumstances. But as far as Hitler and Goering was concerned, that was enough. The Luftwaffe will supply Stalingrad.
Right. Okay. So isolated, supply lines were cut. The weather was pretty atrocious closing in. So in effect, the only way in was by air.
Yeah.
That was the only way that those isolated troops could be supported.
Yes.
And they were only to defend their positions. They were never to retreat. Hitler made that very clear. They were never to retreat. So in effect, supply from the air was the only route in. So we talked very briefly then about their capabilities and not really their capacity, but can you outline for us how they organized themselves to start delivering this airlift? How did it sort of come into being?
Okay, so the main German air power, as I said, there was no specialist transport command. So the main German air power contingent in southern Russia at that time was the 4th Air Fleet in German Luftflotte 4, which was commanded by Generalfeldmarschall von Richthofen. Now, it was a vast area. He had to, it's an enormous tract of land. basically the Crimea running into the Caucasus as the Germans theoretically took land, right up to the north, further north along the Volga, up to Kharkov. It was a vast tract of land. And he had to perform reconnaissance, bombing missions, JU-87s with, you know, close support missions, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it was about 2,500 aircraft, 3,000 aircraft, which sounds a lot, but it isn't, because then you have serviceability issues. And as the weather changes, that gets harder. But the main thing he lacked for this mission was transports. He didn't have transports. So Goering, as is relatively well known, says to Hitler, "I can supply the Sixth Army. We can do it." But there's the small technical problem that the main air fleet in charge doesn't have the transports. Now, within the air fleet, there were two sub-commands, the 8th Flying Corps, the 8th Flieger Corps, and the 4th Flying Corps. And the 8th Flieger Corps traditionally had been a close support, ground attack flying corps. It was predominantly, you know, it had bombed its way around Europe in the Blitzkrieg campaigns. And it was the Stukas of the 8th Flieger Corps that basically had bombed Stalingrad, along with some 111s and some JU-88s. And this was commanded by a man called General Martin Fiebig, who was a hardworking, very dedicated, former First World War flyer, promoted to general rank, given command of the 8th Flieger Corps. And suddenly, these two guys, Richthofen and Fiebig, who were close support ground attack specialists, were told, "You've got to organize an airlift." Now, I mean, it sounds easy, but it isn't. You know, you have to have specialist skills. You have to know about supply. You have to know about the pulses of supply. How are you going to get the supply? You have to have people who know how to handle supplies at various air bases. You've got to know about, you know, the rate of landing supplies in a pocket, you know, and what the conditions are like. This isn't just about sending Stukas off to go and bomb a factory and come back. There are complications. The specialist knowledge was lacking. There was a man called Mortzig, Fritz Mortzig, who was a senior transport commander. He was there, but no one really listened to him. He wasn't given much priority in German thinking.
Right.
So bit by bit, they clawed aircraft in from Germany. They took aircraft from North Africa, where Rommel desperately needed them. These JU-52s were brought in from North Africa. The training schools were stripped dry. Instructor pilots, Deutsche Lufthansa, you know, civilian pilots, factory pilots, anything they could lay their hands on. Anyone who could fly a JU-52. Now that's fine, but let's look at the JU-52. Great aeroplane, but you know, if an aeroplane has been flying historically over the Mediterranean to North Africa, it's not set up for winter use where the temperatures are starting to go towards zero and below. So again, they were just really caught short. There'd been no planning. And so there was this desperate scramble to get different types of aeroplane.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Did you know that the first G-suit for British pilots was essentially a chest-high pair of fisherman's waders which were filled with 2 gallons of water? The water automatically squeezed the pilot's legs as positive G was applied. Did you also know that the Islamic Republic of Iran Air Force's oldest McDonnell Douglas F-4D Phantom is set to clock up more than 70 years in service, having been delivered in 1968 and now subject to life extension programs taking it to 2040. If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
And Robert, just, I suppose, again, putting some context around those aircraft availabilities and types, there was, the initial estimates were that they'd need 500 tons of supplies a day to keep that army not only alive, but operating, fed, ammunition, fuel. But the aircraft weren't all the right types. They weren't all the right shapes and sizes. And the very first airlifts barely got 50, 60, 70 tons a day into that army.
Yeah.
So if you think of a fighting army, the first thing you're going to think of is ammunition and supplies for them to fight. Tell us what was needed on this airlift, because those are the obvious things. But to keep an army of how many, gosh, how many thousands
initially it was around 264,000 thereabouts,
yeah,
including some Romanians and Italian allies.
Right, okay. So they needed everything, not just ammunition.
They did. They needed food. They also needed fodder for their horses. And when, you know, the thing with they were tanks, but most of the army corps that were stuck in Stalingrad, there was a lot of artillery, and that was not necessarily mechanically pulled artillery. There's another thing with Barbarossa, the German invasion of Russia, is they used horses, and in the Caucasus they actually had camels as well and oxen, you know, pulling guns. There were thousands of horses, so they needed fodder. They needed fuel. They desperately needed fuel and you know, ammunition. They needed medical supplies. They needed winter clothing because they were, you know, when they reached Stalingrad, it was late summer. And by the time the airlift commenced in November, you know, things had got cold, but the troops just couldn't, you know, say, oh, you know, we're just going to get in a lorry or a train and go to Berlin and pick up some clothing and come back. Is that all right, you know, Mr. General Zhukov? No, it didn't work. I mean, so they needed clothing, they needed fuel, they needed medical supplies, they needed food, for their horses. They needed, you know, just about everything. Oil, they needed oil for keeping the guns, you know, functioning. They needed hydraulic oil. They needed all sorts of things. One of the terrible things was what they actually got. Some of the things that they actually got flown in was awful. I mean, you know, they were sending roofing felt and condoms and ladies fur coats because they'd had a winter relief effort. So they were sending.
Yeah. Balancing that off, Robert, I mean, one of the facts that sticks in my mind is the artillery teams were using 100 tons of shells per day. So just to keep them on their current firing rate, and I'm not an artillery expert, but they were going through 100 tons of shells a day, just shells.
Yeah.
It's just phenomenal.
I know. And as you said, Peter, and what were they lifting? 70 tons, 75 tons. I think the biggest tonnage they got in one day was the greatest, the nearest they got to it. Right. So just to come back to a point you mentioned just then, that 500 tons, you're absolutely right. 500 tons was what Paulus at one point said, this is what we need to continue as a functioning army. In fact, before that, he'd said, or the sixth, I don't want to say it's Paulus, but the sixth army had said, you know, ideally, we need 750 tons a day. So if we start at that 750 tons a day, then pretty early on, when they knew things were going against them, the pinches are closed, they said, okay, we need 500 tons a day. And it slowly came down to, we can survive on 300 to 350 tons a day. That's what we need to survive. And as you absolutely said, Peter, that's an interesting statistic. 100 tons a day, did you say, in artillery shells? So, yep. You know, you just have to do the maths. I mean,
I know, it's frightening. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So let's talk then about the types of aircraft. We mentioned the good old anti-Junkers, and whilst that was the workhorse, that wasn't the only aircraft available. They had to rely on what was available and what they could get hold of, and that always didn't fit the plan. It didn't fit the conditions. Tell us about some of the other aircraft that were involved in the airlift then.
Well, okay. So apart from the JE-52, which was a real workhorse, that could take about 2 tons of cargo, of freight. And it was about an hour and, I think it was about an hour and 15 minutes to run to get to Stalingrad. So they then realized we haven't got enough of these, as you rightly say. So the next aircraft they had, which they could use, was the Heinkel 111. And the Heinkel 111, which, you know, you and I will always associate, as we saw in the film, the Battle of Britain and all the rest of it, you know, we associate it with being a bomber. It was actually a very good multi-role aircraft. It did everything from dropping bombs. It was a courier aircraft. It was an ambulance aircraft. It was a close support aircraft. It could have been an airliner. It dropped leaflets. And it was a very, very versatile and very widely used aeroplane. And the Heinkel 111 could also take about 3 to 4 tons internally, as well as a combination of external supply containers loaded externally, and we'll come on to that in a moment. So the Heinkel 111 was bought in, and Fiebig's 8th Flying Corps, which was comprised a lot, they had several Geschwader wings of bombers. These guys had to, and this is where it started to bite. This is where this thing got very challenging for the Luftwaffe. So they had to suspend combat operations in support of the Blau summer offensive as it ground to a halt steadily in the winter. They had to take these aircraft away from supporting the southern thrust into the Caucasus. And they had to use these transports as makeshift transports. These Heinkel 111s were used as transports. There were some units that were already Heinkel 111 transports because it was a versatile aircraft. But they bought in KG-27, for example, KG-55. They bought in bomber units that were bomber units and hastily converted to fly as transports. They also had the Junkers 86, the JU-86, which was this big old aircraft from they're all from the 30s, but another 1930s aircraft that had diesel engines. And, you know, what it went out to, you know, why it ended up going to Stalingrad. I mean, it struggled with strong headwinds. It could take only about 0.8 tons of cargo. They had to find diesel oil because they were diesel engines. I mean, it was just a training aeroplane, but they actually got small numbers of JU-86s out to these frozen airfields. And that numbers of those partook in the airlift. And then at a certain point, eventually Richthofen had been banging on the table saying, we desperately need more aeroplanes. So they ended up sending, they realized they had to have planes that could lift higher cargoes, higher rates of higher tonnages. So they brought in the Fokker Wolf 200 Condor. Now, this was a beautiful, elegant, four-engined, pre-war civilian airliner, lovely aeroplane, which then gave a very good account of itself in the Battle of the Atlantic, as we discussed previously. the Condor, which you know, it performed a good, you know, good. But again, to send these things out to temperatures of minus 20, minus 30 degrees centigrade, four engines needed servicing, not three, not two, four. You've got to have spares and parts. Anyway, they sent a group of these aircraft out to Stalingrad. Now, the Fokker Wolf Condor could take 5 tons, and actually, it did actually give a relatively good account of itself. But the problem was, the weakness there was its undercarriage, and in snow and ice, and you know, everything else. And actually, if you like, I can the commander of this group that flew Condors, Fokker Wolf Condors, I mean, I can read a brief extract.
That'd be lovely.
His words. He said his name was Major Villers, and he said, this is talking about the Condors, working on the aircraft at minus 30 degrees centigrade in snowstorms without any protection was hopeless. On several occasions, we had to use the warming carts to thaw out the mechanics who had become frozen to the aircraft with wrenches in their hands. Furthermore, the heating carts were only sufficient for 3 engines, so another was needed for the 4th engine, and often to release frozen tailwheels. In addition, trying to protect such large aircraft from the elements was a futile affair, since if a tarpaulin of sufficient size was found, it was invariably torn by the act of handling it in such icy weather, or the wind would tear it apart. Either that, or 3 engines would have to be left running idle while the cart was refueled. It was also an extreme and difficult process of acclimatization for our personnel to go from plus 20 degrees centigrade at their previous base of Bordeaux to minus 30 degrees centigrade at Stalino or Zaporozhye, which is in the news at the moment. So that was the Condor. And then the other 2 aircraft they brought in, as we discussed in a previous episode, was the big old JU-290. Bigger, enormous. Now that could carry 10 tons and it could also get out 80 wounded personnel, because the other thing with the airlift was to evacuate wounded personnel. So this big old JU-290, massive civil airliner. And then the other aircraft that was used was the Heinkel 177 bomber, which was a disastrous aeroplane. In fact, the pilots called it the Reich's cigarette lighter. It could only take 3 tons of cargo, it could carry 3 tons externally. There were 2 engines that were put into 1 unit. They broke down. They blew up. It was absolutely hopeless. But again, these poor guys were sent to Russia, these bomber pilots, and were told they had to fly into the pocket. And so there you have it, the JU-52.
No, I was just going to say, Robert, you talked there about maintenance, but the aircraft had a whole logistics chain in their own right, trying to keep them there, which they struggled for parts, they struggled for maintenance people, ground crew, and all sorts of things. All these things you just assume turn up. They struggled with all of that. But also they had to overfly the Russians as well.
Yes.
So these air crew, pilots, loadmasters, and all those familiar roles to us, many of which were not battle weary. Some of them battle weary, sorry, not weary. They probably were. Also didn't have those sort of tactical skills as well, because they come, as you said, from Lufthansa. They were flying these big, heavy aircraft. Tell us about some of the challenges just getting the aircraft through from what was their friendly position over the Russians and into another unfriendly environment.
Yes. Well, initially the Luftwaffe grouped, they had 2 main bases at Tatsinskaya and Morozovskaya. The first was the JU-52, the main JU-52 hub, and the second was the main Heinkel 111 hub. Now, Tatsinskaya was about, I think it was a run of about 220 kilometers to Stalingrad. Morozovskaya was a little bit less. So, initially they thought they could fly during daylight. And strangely enough, aside from the weather, and the weather was obviously a big, big factor, because, often what they found was when they took off from the supply bases, the other thing was that Stalingrad happened to sit in an area of almost like a microclimate. So by the time they'd actually got airborne from Morozovskaya or Tsarskaya or Stalino or Salsk or any of the other airfields they used, by the time they actually got within range of Stalingrad, the weather could change very, very quickly. So they may have taken off in bitterly cold but clear weather. But by the time they got to the pocket, conditions could change drastically. They would hit heavy cloud, they would hit snow, they would hit, you know, fog, mist, everything that could be chucked at them, meteorologically speaking, they had to endure. Initially, they thought we'd better fly singly. You know, that's just what they thought they would do, send aircraft off at 5-10 minute intervals if they could get them up in the air that quickly. But that was dangerous because they didn't have protection. They could get lost. So then they had to say, well, we'll fly in groups of three aircraft, or maybe even larger groups of 6-10 aircraft at a time, the Junkers 52s. Problem with that is that's fine if you've got lovely conditions at the receiving end, where as you said, a loadmaster would be down on the ground saying, yeah, you can come in, you've got radio communication. Yeah. Now, the Germans did actually have radio beacons, and they were useful. They did work. So there were aids for navigation. But initially, the Soviet fighter presence over the pocket was quite negligible. But I don't really know the reasons for that. I must admit, I haven't gone into the VVS operating strategy too much. But as the airlift progressed, the VVS, as the Soviet Air Force was called, did start to increase their fighter presence. And they became a real headache. And not only that, but they ended up, as the Russian pincers closed around the city, so within their pincers, the Soviets set up anti-aircraft gun belts.
Yeah.
With a lot of searchlights. Because also the Luftwaffe crews then said, well, we've got to fly at night. A, because we've got to maintain the momentum and this
of the lift,
minimum of 300 tons of the lift, exactly, of 300 tons a day. We've got to maintain that. So we're going to have to fly day and night, weather allowing or weather not allowing, as the case may be. Hmm. So they then had to run the gauntlet of weather. They then had to run the gauntlet of LAG-1s and Yak fighters and Sturmoviks. They then had to run searchlights, flak, the Russians set up rings of anti-aircraft. They lost 488 aircraft as a result of this airlift from early November 1942 until very early the 2nd of February 1943. Nearly 500 transports were lost. Don't forget, Peter, they were still having to supply. Rommel still needed supplies in North Africa.
Yeah.
And they'd lost 488 transports.
And not only those aircraft, fighters, but those crews as well. Those trained crews.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think 1,000 crew were lost. And some of these guys were just trained, you know, all the investment in just training a crew. There were instructor pilots. There were Knight's Cross holders who had won the Knight's Cross for conducting bombing missions in other Luftwaffe.
Yeah. You
know, highly experienced airmen just gone because Hitler said, I do not want to leave the Volga. You must stay on the Volga. I will not give ground. So tactics were, I think it's fair to say units devised their own tactics. It was all a bit fluid.
Which feels so unusual for the Germans, because we all, you know, and again, one of the things, and I have to say this, Robert, I'm sort of conflicted in trying to analyze this, because I've been brought up with this Allied sort of bias. But reading the book and reading the detail, there was some phenomenal bravery from those crews.
Yeah.
I mean, you talked about the weather. You know, the conditions we talk about now where airliners fly, you know, 40,000 feet up in the air in minus 30, minus 40, minus 50.
Yeah.
These were conditions at ground level or at 1,000 feet, these crews.
Yeah.
So some of the flying was extremely brave, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, and I in the book I was very fortunate to come in contact with the a relative of a man called Adolf Spohr, who was a young man who was a bomber pilot. He trained as a bomber pilot, and he flew one these Heinkel 177s, dreadful aeroplanes, by all accounts. And he had trained fellow pilots. He was also specialist in flying captured French aircraft, and he flew his first mission to the pocket, and he said it was horrendous. It was so sad seeing, you know, these trapped men below you, because the lights of their fires, and they wanted to get down to land, and they couldn't. They were not allowed to because of conditions at the airfields at Potomac and later Gumrak. They just couldn't. So they were reduced to airdropping. Everything became airdropping. And on one mission, they endured, you know, search lights, Soviet anti-aircraft fire. They were at very low level in this lumbering, very unreliable, very dangerous aeroplane. They were flying at night. There were Soviet night fighters, not many, but there were. And he managed to fly one mission and airdrop his consignment of cargo. Took off on his first mission, didn't come back. So that's a very experienced pilot, just lost. And just the adversity was just awful. And for the men on the ground, and what must have been so dispiriting for some of these pilots and air crews was, when they had got down onto the ground at Potomac and Gumrak, the main bases that the Sixth Army had, and there was a Luftwaffe general called Pickert that was in the pocket as well, and he performed a real major and sterling role in the pocket. But when these crews did get down onto the ground, if they did get down on there with the snow drifts and you know, in the darkness and in freezing weather, often the aircraft would be charged by desperate men, you know, desperate to get out, because they were, you know, they were also trying to bring back wounded as well. And, you know, what you've got to imagine if this was the RAF, okay? So you imagine a Hercules or a you know, a Dakota several, you know, 70 years ago, whatever. Yep. You imagine an RAF crew physically having to kick their fellow countrymen, their soldiers, away from the aircraft and level guns at them to keep them away from the aircraft. And there were stories of guys, there's a story in the book of a Heinkel 111 crew. They just loaded up. They got, I think, 12 or 13 men on board, which is the most they could do, wounded men on board. And the pilot says to one of the flight engineer, there's something wrong with the rudder. Can you just go and check the rudder? And he opens the hatch. He jumps back on the ground, goes back to check the rudder, fixes it. Now make sure it's all right. And he sees this guy holding on to the undercarriage of the 111, ready to cling on to it. As the Heinkel would have taken off. And he just says, you can't do that. And he has to kick him away. There's another horrific story of a soldier running towards a Heinkel 111, and he gets decapitated in the propellers of the 111. I mean, it was just desperate. And there was a terrible. I can read you another, you know, on the, it's terrible. And there was this road to Potomac airfield, and there was a war reporter called Heinz Schroeter who's written a book, and you know, he describes that there were motorcycles and ambulances and lorries trying to get along to this one road to the airfield at Potomac, where there was also a field hospital. And he said in his memoirs, he said that before they died, these men crawled meter by meter, or their comrades dragged them on tarpaulins or boards or in ammunition cases. Then more snow would fall, and in the darkness, the lorries would jolt over things that splintered and broke beneath their wheels. Frozen bones cracked like glass. And that was something that really struck when I was writing the book, how awful the conditions were. It was awful. It was horrific.
Shocking. Let's then look at how the airlift moved on. Where did it then, you know, day in, day out, night in, night out, this was going on? How did this then come to some form of conclusion? What happened?
Well, the end phase, really, that when Pitomnik, which was the main field, was lost, and Gumrak eventually became lost. Gumrak was the second field. There were other landing spots, but they were little more than just frozen, compacted earth. When eventually the airfields were lost, all they could resort to was airdropping. So they developed wooden containers with metal ends, with primitive shock absorbers, you know, mattress material and springs at each end and stuff like this, which were parachute dropped. And that was another awful thing where I don't mean to laugh, but it's just extraordinary. I mean, in a Heinkel 111, often they would, you know, get these containers to drop out of the bomb bay, but sometimes they would prematurely open up. So a parachute would open up inside the aircraft, you know, which was awful. And then lines and rigging would get locked into the bomb bay and they'd have to cut the shrouds with knives. But anyway, so eventually, Peter, it just became an airdropping operation, which would either involve, as I said, air canisters. You know, they wanted red. The men in the Sixth Armies constantly said, please send us red parachutes because then we can see where they landed. But of course, the supply organization in Germany, it wasn't the Fourth Air Fleet. This was the supply. They could only get material in from Germany. Of course, they kept sending white parachutes, which became next to useless because it was very difficult for them to recover. You know, they couldn't see where they're landing, and men were getting weaker by the day. So to go out in snow that was waist deep, where you're malnourished, you're down to the minimum calorie intake in temperatures of, you know, minus 20, minus 30 degrees, to go and recover, a 1,000 kilo, recovery container is very difficult. So that was difficult. And things like flour and bags, you know, sacks and things, if they were pushed out of a fuselage, they would often split and break. And the other thing was, how it came to a conclusion was the Germans did try to launch a relief under Field Marshal von Manstein. They tried to launch an operation called Wintergewitter, a winter storm, from the south, which was intended to try to relieve Stalingrad.
To break through, one, yeah.
And that failed. Hitler sent out a man called Erhard Milch, who was a kind of another, he was the Secretary of State and deputy head of Luftwaffe. And he was a very dynamic man who basically built up Lufthansa in the interwar years. And he was in charge of aircraft production. He failed. He got out there too late. He went with big ideas. He was going to use cargo gliders, towed gliders. But by that time, the airfields in the pocket had gone. And this dynamic individual, he failed. So it just literally stuttered to a stop. The Soviet ring got tighter and tighter. The pocket started to shrink. More Russian fighters, more anti-aircraft guns. And it just shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. Tonnages started to drop. They had to fly only by night. Serviceability of the German aircraft involved fell. Yeah. And towards the last few days of the airlift, they were lucky if they got, you know, 20 tons, 30 tons. And it's so dispiriting for these air crews flying at night, watching just the occasional fire down below, which might mark out a small German unit. And the pocket was just shrinking and shrinking. And it was terrible, really.
Okay. Looking back then and looking back at how this airlift as a logistics exercise worked, what were the sort of tonnages we saw then? Where did it end up? Because we started the 40s, 50s, 60s a day, but did they ever reach the 300, 400, 500 a day?
No. The highest they ever reached, I think, was it was 265 tons a day.
Right.
And I think they have, on average, I think it was about 70 tons a day they were flying in. So it was way, way below any sustainable. You raise a very good point about the artillery shells. I mean, you know, they're firing 100 tons of those a day, and the Luftwaffe is averaging 70 tons a day, you know. But it's very easy to point, no, and I'm not suggesting that either of us are, but it's understandable to point the finger of blame at the Luftwaffe. Actually, in writing this book, and when I sort of finally laid down my pen, so to speak, I thought about it, and I just thought they did a remarkable job in keeping them going from mid-November, keeping them supplied with anything. And actually, the Sixth Army was, the soldiers in the Sixth Army were incredibly grateful to the Luftwaffe. Could Sixth Army have broken out? In my opinion, and this is a very controversial, you know, I know people disagree, and there was a point when Manstein was, I forget the distance, but they got pretty close to the pocket. There was the 4th Panzer Army was quite close.
Right.
And I think had Paulus pulled down from the north of the pocket, got his few tanks left, I think they could have tried to make a breakout. And the Luftwaffe could have airdropped supplies as they broke out and headed towards Manstein. That's
right.
Basically what I think. But the Luftwaffe was never given that opportunity to do that because Hitler said the Sixth Army must remain on the Volga and you will not give up any ground.
Yeah.
And so there they stayed and there they died. And Paulus did not have the strength of character. He dithered. He didn't know what to do. And the final irony, and this shows Hitler's sort of, you know, his Machiavellian sort of, you know, he promotes Paulus to field marshal in the very dying days of the airlift. He says, right, I'm promoting you to field marshal because you don't. Now that's fine. But of course, the psychology in that of German field marshal never surrenders and has never surrendered.
Yeah.
And, Hitler was really applying psychology. And right to the end, Goering maintained that the Luftwaffe, his, as he kept calling it, my Luftwaffe, will keep Sixth Army supplied. And in that, they failed. They just failed. But I don't think you can pin the responsibility on the air crews or the Junkers 52s or the Heinkel 111s, you know, operating in such appalling conditions. And you can't pin it on the air commanders in the field. You can't do that. They did the best they could.
A question then, Robert, that I've only just thought of, actually. So you're a little bit unprepared for this, but did the Luftwaffe during the airlift support the operation with any strike capability? Were they attacking the Russians? Were they using, you know, those Heinkels in their ground attack role?
Yeah, all the time. And there was a moment when the Russians launched a counteroffensive, which was known as Little Saturn, in mid-December, to really, and then they had a second operation called Kolzer Ring, Operation Ring, where they were really, you know, Stalin said, right, let's squeeze them dry. Now, you know, T-34s are coming in, Soviet armor's coming in, there's one command there, which is Luftwaffe 4, the 4th Air Fleet, run by Richthofen. And his other corps, the 4th Flying Corps, was further south trying to render support to the German armies going into the Caucasus. So again, Richthofen had to make do with these slender resources of aircraft. And he would say to his bomber crews, stop dropping supplies, go and shoot up tanks. And you've got to move 200 miles to the north, or, you know, you've got to relocate. You've got to fly. You've got to leave this airfield. You've got to fly 200 miles further north because there's a Soviet tank breakthrough, and you've got to go back to offensive, you know, low-level bomb dropping operations. Because by that time, unless it was really, really, really close support, JU-87s weren't, JU-87s were operating. They were fighting tanks on the battlefield, but, you know, that, you know, they had to bomb, you know, the Luftwaffe had to target ammunition dumps for the tanks and things like this. So yes, they were very much, and actually, Peter, they were conducting offensive operations over the ruins of Stalingrad. You know, they were dropping their bombs quite close to German positions. And right. I think the troops on the ground in Sixth Army could see that the Luftwaffe was doing this. I don't think there were troops on the ground that felt the Luftwaffe wasn't doing anything, far, far from it. So, yeah, they did maintain combat operations all the way around Stalingrad. And the Italian, basically what happened was the Russians broke through from the north through the Italian and Romanian armies. They identified where a weak point in the German line was. And they sent a big tank thrust through from the north, which just broke through the Axis line. And Richthofen had to suddenly divert, you know, potentially half of his airlift capacity back to conducting offensive operations. So it was kind of like a fire brigade effort all the way through. And there are so many angles. I mean, can you imagine trying to run this thing?
it's an amazing book, Robert. There's so much detail in here I think I was quite overwhelmed with the achievement that you've made in this book. It's quite phenomenal. I never knew a great deal about this particular element of the Stalingrad battles. So it really brought to life the challenges. And as I said, trying to think of it neutrally, because, you know, it's like unconscious bias. So I started reading it thinking, oh my gosh, I've got a particular view about that. But as you know, you've talked about some of the bravery, some of the personal stories, some of the stories in this book, you don't have to be allied, Axis, or anything to understand the torment and the trauma that those humans went through on both sides, I might add. So it was an interesting personal dilemma reading this, having come through that sort of very biased approach. So I really thank you for the work you've done. I know this was at least 2 years of work, because we were talking about it over a year ago. But Robert, where can we find the book? Where can we find out a bit more about it? Where can people get it from?
It's published by Osprey Publishing, so it's available through the publisher's website at www.ospreypublishing.com. It's on Amazon, and it is definitely available through all good bookstores. It should be widely available.
And can we follow you online anywhere, Robert? Are you a social media junkie?
I wouldn't say that I'm a junkie, but I do maintain a Facebook page, and I'm probably going to get my own website set up at some point in time. But I am on Facebook, and make postings, and also on LinkedIn as well. And
We'll put some links to those in the show notes. But thanks again, Robert. It's been fascinating.
Okay, great. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. And well done for everything you guys do as well.
appreciate it. We really enjoy it. We get to talk to people like you. And for those of you who are listening to this, I'm looking at Robert in his, I'll describe it as his office, but it looks like a fantastic aviation man cave to me. So next time.
It's very untidy.
So next time we do this face to face. But thanks again, Robert. Right. If you'd like to support the program, we welcome listener donations, reviews on Apple Podcast, and 5-star reviews on Spotify. I'd like to thank our most recent reviewers, Agent K. Thank you very much for that review. Please remember to follow us on our social media platforms, and we really do enjoy hearing from you and what you think about our content. So don't be shy. You know, we've just heard for the last hour or so a fantastic review of an element of the Second World War that I think is pretty well untouched. If you've got a view, if you've got a question for Robert, please do contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Please follow the Aviation Historian on Twitter. That's AV Historian. Mick and the team there would love to hear from you as well. You can find me, Peter Johnson, at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find the whole extended team of Ellie, Gareth, and Tim on Twitter, Facebook, and of course on Instagram as well. So that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Robert.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.